me, and I hear the sounds of movement at his end. I'm leaving right now. Wade is an excellent father, although if you viewed his behavior only through the lens of his interactions with Eddie, you'd suspect the opposite. He rarely engages with Eddie. He's constantly resistant to the therapies that help our son to survive in the world. He's dismissive and impatient, and he's unsupportive. But with our daughter, Pascal, or Callie, as we usually call her, Wade is a model parent. He's genuinely busy with his job, but he finds a way to be at all of the key events in her life. Debate club meets, ballet recitals, parent-teacher interviews, doctor's appointments. Callie and Wade usually do her homework together, though she rarely needs his help. They are 12 chapters into the last Harry Potter book because they have read alternate pages aloud to each other every night without fail over the past 3 years. She had her first crush last year, and she told Wade about little Tyler Wilson before she even told me. I can't even remember the last time Wade and Eddie were alone together. Wade would say we had a perfectly normal son until Eddie was 18 months old, and I took him to a doctor who put a label on our boy, and that label tainted everything. Wade would say I was so convinced that something was wrong with Eddie that it became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Then I spent so much time trying to fix him that I actually made him broken. And he's kind of right about the paranoia, because from the moment I realized I was pregnant, I knew that something was different. Even I don't understand how I knew, so I can appreciate that to Wade it might seem that I made all of this happen somehow, at least at first. Maybe that theory could have been valid, right up until Eddie was 2, and the developmental pediatrician said the words autism spectrum disorder. We didn't yet understand how bad it was going to be, but surely that diagnosis was a clear sign that this situation was way out of my control. It is beyond me how my brilliant husband, a man with a PhD and an entire research program under his guidance, can fail to understand how utterly helpless I am when it comes to our son. I am a puppet controlled by medical professionals and therapists. They tell me all the things I need to do to engage with Eddie. Some of those things, like the AAC on the iPad, help me to reach him. But most of their therapies don't reach him at all. They simply enable us to survive. None of those therapies made him different. Eddie just is different. That's where my opinion and Wade's diverge. Wade would say all of my efforts enable a spoiled little boy who could be closer to typical if we just pushed him more instead of pandering to him. Wade speaks to Eddie because he can't accept that Eddie's language is really as restricted as I know it is. Wade views Eddie's echolalia as a game, a way to insult and taunt us, and of proof that Eddie could use verbal language to communicate if he wanted to. It doesn't help that when Eddie sees Wade, he often echoes the words, "Not now, Edison." Although I'm not even sure why that one has even persisted, because Eddie no longer makes much of an attempt to engage with his father at all. What Wade loves to forget is that initially, he was quite supportive of medical intervention. He seemed to have this idea that Eddie's diagnosis automatically meant our son would be a savant, and Wade was kind of okay with the whole situation, right up until the psychologist told us that Eddie's IQ was a little under average, so he was unlikely to possess any quirky but genius abilities. My husband is a quirky genius himself. He could handle having a brilliant but odd child. In fact, we have one of those already in Callie, and he's her best friend in the world. It was the below average designation that Wade couldn't deal with. The autism itself was just the straw that broke the camel's back. That's when the blame game started. But I don't judge Wade for that because I play it too. My husband, and more importantly, his sperm, have spent an awful lot of time around intense industrial chemicals over the years, and he's been exposed to radiation at work more than once. And heavens, left to his own devices, Wade's diet is appalling. We blame each other for Eddie's struggles. The only difference is Wade occasionally has the courage to voice his thoughts on the matter aloud. Maybe that makes him a better person, because at least he's honest. I carry my resentment of Wade around like a millstone around my neck, and some days I just know that sooner or later, something is going to snap. He arrives 22 minutes after our call, and just as I expected, he's frazzled. Wade wears a suit to work because he's an executive manager these days. When he leaves home in the morning, his tie is always impressively straight. Right now, it's at a somewhat crazy angle, and his blonde hair is sticking up all over the place. He looks sheepish as he enters the hospital room, his hands caught through the straining handles of 2 overloaded Hessian bags. "Hi, guys," he says pointlessly to Bobcha and Eddie on the bed. Then he nods at me and raises the bag in his left hand.
I got a whole carton of soup. It's in the car. Then they had plenty of stock of the old yogurt labels, so I bought it all. Here's half of it.
He lifts the other bag a little higher and nods toward it.
And I got heaps with the new label, too.
At my blank stare, he says hesitantly,
Well, you know, so he could get used to it.
Eddie won't get used to the label. I don't know how we're going to manage that yet, but the fact that Wade thinks it's that easy is a blatant reminder of how little he understands.
Thanks.
I expect Wade to pass me the bags, kiss me politely, and spin on his heel. But instead, he sets the bags on the floor and pulls me into an embrace. I'm surprised by this, and even more surprised when he places a gentle kiss on the side of my hair.
Sorry, Allie. Honestly, I'm really sorry. I know you're under a lot of pressure at the moment, and I'm not much help.
I sigh and lean into him, then wind my arms around his torso and accept comfort from the warmth of his embrace.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Rare glimpses of the man I know my husband to be have sustained our marriage. In these sporadic moments, I catch a hint of hope on the horizon. All I need to keep working and fighting and trying is a glimmer of that, just every now and again. This one comes right when I need it.
I'm kind of on a short fuse emotionally, I whisper. I'm really sorry, too. About before. Would it help if I stay this afternoon?
He doesn't offer to take Eddie home, but this is as close as I'm going to get, and I appreciate the offer. Actually, I say, Callie has ballet at 4. If you could go pick her up from school, take her to ballet, then go home and cook some dinner.
Absolutely, Wade says with enthusiasm.
Or maybe it's relief.
Absolutely, I can do that. Anything you need.
He brushes his lips against mine, then glances at the bed again.
How are you doing, Babcia?
She can't understand you, I remind him. She's been using the AAC. If you want to talk to her, you'll have to use that. Wade stiffens, then waves vaguely at the bed and glances at his watch.
I might head back to the office and tell them I'm going to take off early. I'll see you at home tonight. Let me know if you need anything else.
Okay, I say. Lunch, Eddie's iPad says. Then, lunch, 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 lunch. Okay, okay, I sigh, and I bend and fetch a pack of yogurt. He's so excited that he sits up and his hands start flapping all over the place. 6 tubes of yogurt later, Eddie is settled on the bed watching YouTube videos of trains again. But then, Mom flies back into the room with an archive box in her hand, and Babcia brightens until she's the one impatiently flapping her hands. Chapter 7 Alice Mom slides the box onto the tray table while I shift Eddie to the chair beside the bed. Babcia grows impatient and she pushes herself into a sitting position without our assistance. So then we have to hasten to adjust the angle of her bed and fix her pillows. She waves us away and reaches for the box, her hands trembling. There's reverence in her gaze, and every now and then she flicks a glance toward Mom that's brimming with gratitude and relief. I have to help Babcia to lift the lid off the box when it becomes apparent she can't coordinate her right hand to do so. But once I do, she pulls the lid against herself and hugs it awkwardly with her forearms.
Where was it? I ask Mom quietly.
Under her bed at the retirement unit. I missed it the first time I went there, Mom mutters as she shakes her head. I didn't realize how close she keeps it, but I probably should have. She's always been so sentimental.
She makes that last statement as though this is an utterly bewildering character trait, which momentarily amuses me.
So are you, Mom, I laugh softly, and she frowns at me.
You forget I helped you and Dad move last time. I know your attic is basically the museum of the Slosky Davis family. She's kept artworks and school reports for me right from preschool and ticket stubs from her early dates with Dad. And because she is a stickler for the letter of the law, she's kept sentimental paperwork from her journey to the bench, but she's self-redacted, identifying details where that might be problematic from a confidentiality point of view. I tried to thin the boxes of mementos out a little when they were moving, but Mom stubbornly held on to every last piece of our history. And when I pointed out how pointless those redacted files seemed to be, she told me that each and every page triggers a memory of a case that meant something to her. I suspect that my mom is scared that one day she'll get dementia like Pa did. Maybe those bits and pieces from our past are important in case they one day need to act as a map to guide her back to the memories she cherishes. In the meantime, it's kind of hilarious that above my mother's industrial, minimalist-styled house is an attic brimming with boxes of macaroni art, letters, and unsorted photographs. Mom sighs now, but she gives me a rueful smile. I suppose she taught me that some things just can't be replaced, Mom murmurs, and we both look back to Babcia, who's awkwardly wiping tears from her face as she stares into the box. She never said so, Mom adds, but I always assumed these little things came to mean so much more to her because she had to uproot herself from her whole life back there in Poland. Babcia motions impatiently toward Eddie's iPad, and he's partway through a train video, so I fully expect him to resist and maybe even grunt like a toddler as he pulls the device against himself. Instead, he looks up at her, blinks, then swipes to the AAC and hands it to her. Babcia smiles at him, then she taps the thank you icon and shows it to Mom, who nods as she sinks into the chair on the opposite side of the bed. As soon as Babcia's attention shifts, Mom rubs her forehead and for the briefest of moments, closes her eyes. She looks exhausted, maybe more tired than I've ever seen her, and I was waiting at the finish line for every one of her 8 marathons. Mom, I say softly, are you okay? I need this hospital to get it together and figure out what's going on with her. I can't keep taking time off. I have a decision pending, and it's just... She stops speaking abruptly, then raises her gaze to me and frowns. It's just all too much, Alice. You just couldn't possibly understand. Any rare glimpse of vulnerability from Mom is always followed up by a reminder of how vitally important she is. And often, a little jab like that one. A reminder of how unimportant my role is by comparison. I do speak with my mom almost every day, and by the standards of most of my friends, we're particularly close. But it's a difficult closeness, because close to Julita Slosky Davis is a difficult place to stay. Almost every day, we end up raising our voices at one another. It's just the dynamic of our family. She doesn't understand this life of mine that revolves around my kids. I don't understand her life that revolves around the law. But we love each other fiercely anyway. Mom was determined that I'd follow in her footsteps and at the very least become a lawyer, and until my late teens, I never even questioned that was to be my path. It was only the year before college that it occurred to me I didn't have to go into law. But when I instead decided to waste my life and study journalism, my relationship with Mom changed forever. It changed again the day I told her I was pregnant, 2 weeks before I was due to graduate. And then the final nail in the coffin was when I didn't even bother looking for a graduate job. There didn't seem any point, since I had no intention of working for several years after my baby's birth. But to Mom, this was unforgivable. Didn't I understand how hard my foremothers fought in the first and second waves of feminism for my right to a career? How could I betray them by accepting a life where I was dependent on a man? Even 10 years later, I still don't have the guts to tell Mom that Callie's conception wasn't an accident, but rather the result of a carefully considered decision that Wade and I took that I would not follow in my mother's footsteps, even in my approach to motherhood. Mom studied, built a career, and then at 43 went into a panic and thought she'd probably better have a child after all. I do so love and admire my mother, but I've spent a lifetime coming second to her work, and I was determined that I would never let my children feel like an afterthought. Wade and I had our kids first, because we were both absolutely sure that I'd find my way into some kind of career once they were at preschool. Then Eddie came along. Life is a way of reminding you that you are at the mercy of chance, and that even well-thought-out plans can turn to chaos in an instant. That's why now, when I might be tempted to condemn my mother for her desperation to return to her job during Babcia's medical crisis, I instead force myself to be patient with her. Mom has been here for 2 days straight, on her own except for the limited time I've spent with her. She has no siblings, I'm her only kid. Dad is retired, but he's on a golfing trip in Hawaii with his old academia buddies, and she is far too proud to ask him to come home. My mom has the weight of the world on her shoulders right now. If she needs to retreat for a little while into her work for some emotional respite, so be it.
Okay, Mom, I say softly. Eddie has school tomorrow. I can come straight to the hospital after I drop him off and sit with her if you want to go to the chambers and catch up a little.
Good, she says, snapping her chin upward.
Thank you, Alice.
Yes, please.
Babcia reaches for my hand and leads it to the box. I lift out a stack of photos and papers and then push the tray table away so I can rest it all on her lap. Her hands move slowly and clumsily as she sorts through this first stack of photos. They are a tumbled confusion of printing technology and eras. Photos of Pa and Mom and me and my kids and Babcia herself over the decades. And a few scant photos of beloved dogs from the days when Babcia and Pa lived in their big house in Oviedo. But just a few layers into the stack, Babcia freezes on a single photo that I've never seen before. It's a sepia print on thick, aged paper. The gloss over the photo is cracked, but the image is still clear. It's a young man sitting casually on a boulder against the background of a forest. He's wearing damaged boots, so well worn that a tattered sock is visible at the toe of the left one. His clothes are equally tired, but he's smiling broadly at the camera. He's incredibly thin, but despite the gaunt cheeks beneath his sparse beard, still handsome. There's something striking about his eyes. He looks like he's holding back a chuckle. Babcia's hands shake as she lifts the photo, and she sighs as she brings it to her cheek, cradling it against her skin. She closes her eyes for a moment and rests her head toward the image. Then she turns to offer it to me. I can tell this is precious to my grandmother, and so I try to take it from her with appropriate reverence. I stare down at the photo in my hands, and it strikes me that this young man is both a stranger and somehow familiar. After a moment, Babcia reaches up toward the photo and turns it over. On the back, I see a scrawled message in faded ink. The tiny handwriting is tightly compressed. Photograph by Henry Adamkiewicz, Trebinia Hill, 1 July, 1941. I read it aloud to Mom, and then I pass the photo back to Babcia.
Poor Babcia. She's really missing Pa, I say,
and Mom frowns and stares at the photo again.
I'm sure she is, Mom says, but that is not Pa.
How do you know?
Pa's hair was dark before he went gray. That man has lighter hair, unless the shades on the print are deceptive, Mom says. Then she shrugs.
Plus, I don't know, that guy just doesn't look like Pa. His eyes are all wrong, the shape of his lips, although there is definitely something familiar about some of his features. He looks a lot like you, actually.
Mama had twin brothers. This must be one of them.
I wonder who Henry Adamkiewicz was. I frown. In 1941. Was that after the war?
No, the war didn't end until 1945, Mom murmurs, and then we all stare at the photo as if it can explain itself.
Babcia wipes a tear from her cheek, then reaches for the iPad again.
Thomas, it says. Find Thomas. Please find Thomas.
Are you sure this isn't Pa? I ask Mom, and then she takes the photo from me and stares at it hard. Then she shakes her head.
I'm quite sure.
Babcia looks so frustrated now that if she could speak, I'm pretty sure she'd be yelling at both of us. I frown and look at Mom, who frowns right back at me. Helplessness and frustration leave my mother looking much more vulnerable than I'm used to, much more human. I feel another alien pang of sympathy for her.
She's so confused, Mom mutters. Then she looks to the door, and the frustration gives rise to anger.
Why won't the staff listen to me? They should be reassessing her cognitive state. Clearly there's more than language damaged here.
Babcia hits the replay button on the iPad.
Please find Thomas. Your turn.
I swallow and take the iPad. Mom is staring at the ceiling now, blinking rapidly. So I guess it's up to me to remind my Babcia that her husband is gone. Rising dread swamps me, and I am shaking a little as I swipe through the screens. Then I groan in frustration and try making my own icon. Pa is D-E-A-D, I type. But Babcia grabs my wrist,
shakes her head fiercely and snatches the iPad from me with surprising strength. She flicks back to the AAC and finds an icon we haven't needed to use in 12 months. Pa. The sight of his image makes the ache in my chest intensify.
No, Pa. Find Thomas.
Then she flicks to the new icon screen and with painstaking effort starts to type. She makes a new icon of her own now. It's a picture of houses, a suburban street. She painstakingly adds a label, Trebinia. The AAC makes an attempt at reading the word aloud, but I'm pretty sure it's not accurate. That word is on the photo, too. Is it a mountain in Poland? I ask Mom. She stands, then frowns as she reads the icon. That's where she grew up. See? She is confused. I told you. I take the iPad and give another fruitless search for a dead symbol, but the best I can do is,
no, Pa. I am sorry.
Again, Babcia shakes her head, her expression twisting now with frustration, and she takes the iPad and she jabs her finger at the screen. She points at me, then at the photo.
Not Pa. Trebinia.
She glances up, sees my confusion, then scrolls through all of the screens until she finds a page of national flags. She selects a red and white one, then adds it to her sentence.
Not Pa. Trebinia. Poland. Thomas.
Eddie is watching all of this with an almost wondrous focus, and he reaches eagerly for the iPad, which Babcia automatically hands to him. He swipes out of the AAC program and loads Google Maps, then quickly types in Poland. The map zooms in on Europe, then centers on Poland, and Babcia points to the lower half of the screen and looks at me as if this should explain everything. It's my turn to take the iPad. I swipe back to the AAC, copy the town name, and then paste it into Google Maps. Eddie squeals with delight as the screen refocuses on the town. Then he claps his hands. I didn't know he knew how to use Google Maps. I make a mental note to mention it to his teacher, because he sure does seem excited about it. Babcia beams at him, then at me. I smile back at her, and for a moment, we're all just sitting there grinning like fools. Is that all she wanted, do you think? I ask Mom, who shrugs. To see a map? Mom surmises, almost wryly. Babcia looks from Mom to me, waits a bit. Then when she realizes we still don't understand her, her face twists into a grimace. She has our full attention, but we're helpless, and soon she's distressed all over again. I'm not sure what to try next, but again, it's Eddie who saves us. He swipes the screen and flips it back to the AAC. Then he hands it to Babcia, and he rests his hand against her forearm. Every time I see a movie where a character has autism and their single defining feature is a lack of empathy, I have an almost overwhelming urge to smash my television. Eddie is, at times, challenging, even maddening, but his heart is immense. He might never speak or live independently, but no one ever tells you that a well-placed hug from the little boy who hates hugs can entirely change your day. Edison Michaels understands frustration better than anyone I know. He recognizes even its most subtle calling cards, because frustration defines every aspect of his life. Babcia types, then plays the words just to make sure we all hear them.
Find Thomas. Please, Mommy. Find Thomas. Trebinia. Poland.
This time when Babcia looks up at me, I stop and I really focus on her. Her eyes are bright and clear. She looks determined and frustrated, and not the least bit bewildered. I still have no idea what she wants, but I am inexplicably certain that she knows. Mom, I say slowly, I don't think she's confused. Alice, she seems to be telling us that her dead husband is in Poland, Mom sighs. Of course she's confused. Pa is in an urn in her retirement unit, for God's sake. For the next several minutes, Babcia repeats herself via the AAC over and over again.
Find Thomas. Please, Mommy. Find Thomas. Trebinia. Poland.
Mom shakes her head and huffs out of breath, then turns away from the bed. Now she wants to talk about Poland, she mutters. Now that she can't talk. You know as well as I do how closed she and Pa were to talking about their life back in Poland. You and I both went through phases as teens where we all but interrogated the woman about the war, and she'd always shut the conversation down.
Find Thomas. Mommy, find Thomas.
I look at Mom again, and she throws her hands into the air. She's calling you Mommy, for God's sake, Mom says in exasperation. But I reach down and edit the label on my photo, then press the icon pointedly.
Alice.
Better, I say to Mom, and she sighs impatiently. Babcia reaches for the iPad again.
Find Thomas, Alice. Please find Thomas. Your turn.
I take the iPad and I stare down at her message. Then I draw in a deep breath and I type a promise I'm not sure I can actually fulfill.
Yes, Babcia. Alice, find Thomas.
She reads the message. Then she looks at me and tears swim in her eyes. I kiss her weathered cheek and sigh.
I suppose we may as well tell her what she wants to hear, Mom says stiffly.
I can understand why Mom said that, but that's not what I'm doing at all. This is no false promise of assistance to my grandmother to bring her comfort. This was the woman who picked me up from school most days and who always had a batch of fresh cookies waiting for me at home. This was the woman who made it to all of my school assemblies and recitals because Mom never could. This woman taught me to deal with heartbreak as a teen and helped me to do my college applications and get my driver's license. But somehow, most importantly, this woman taught me how to be my own kind of woman and wife and mother. I'm the person I am today because of Hannah Slosky, and now that she needs me, I will not let her down. I fully intend to do whatever I can to help her find whatever it is she's looking for.
Chapter 8. Alina. Even in the worst of times, life takes on a rhythm and the days blur into one another. The first year of the occupation was no exception to that rule. Every day ran on routine, and that routine began and ended with thoughts of Thomas. Most of the time, I didn't even let myself consider the possibility that I was pining for a dead man. There was just so much more to worry about. From the day my brothers left, my existence was caged. My parents told me I wasn't to leave the farm, although they would permit the occasional visit with Justyna at the boundary between our properties. I argued against this at first. I was sure I'd find a way to change their minds. I had friends in the town. Emilia and Truda and Mateusz were in the town, and besides, the farm was surely no safer than the township. We often saw Nazi trucks rumbling past on the road at the front of our home. Since the occupation began, even the newspapers had ceased to operate, other than Nazi propaganda publications, which Father refused to read. Wireless, too, was now banned. Father destroyed his precious radio unit after the decree that any Pole found owning such a device would be executed. If I couldn't leave the farm, I'd be cut off from the world altogether. I was desperate for any news at all, but I particularly hoped for news of the work farms or of Warsaw, where I could only assume Tomas remained. When Father made his trips into the town, I'd beg him to let me join him, but nothing I said would sway him. He promised me he was asking after the twins and Tomas, but for the longest time there was no news at all, and with my adolescent arrogance, I was certain that I could do better.
You have heard about the Lapanka, of course, Father told me casually one day.
The game? I asked, frowning. Yes, of course. We played it as children. Lapanka was much like the English game tag. Father shrugged.
The Nazis play Lapanka too, Alina. They block off the ends of the street in the township, and they round up everyone inside and cart them off to a camp or prison for even the slightest reason.
I wouldn't give them a reason, I said stiffly.
Can I see your identity card?
I blinked at him, confused by what I thought was an abrupt change of subject. We'd recently been ordered to carry our identity cards with us at all times, but I was still getting into the habit of carrying mine. And besides, we were in the dining room, so I knew I was safe enough. It's in my room, Father.
Well, there is your reason, Alina, Father said flatly. If a soldier happened by you and caught you without your identity card, they would take you, or maybe shoot you on the spot. Do you understand that? You tell me you want to go into the township, but even here at home, you cannot remember the basic requirements to keep yourself safe.
After that, Mama sewed pockets into all of my skirts for my identity paperwork, and I stewed in my anger toward Father. I was certain that he was being unfair, that I was perfectly capable of remembering the rules if he gave me the chance to prove myself. The problem with rage is that it takes a lot of energy to maintain, and the very nature of our situation with the twins gone was that all of my energy had to be reserved for farm work. Whether or not I was allowed to leave the farm to visit with people in the township became a moot point, because most days I didn't even have the energy to walk to the field boundary for a chat with Justina. And whether or not I had a pocket in my skirt remained equally irrelevant, because most mornings I still forgot to put the identity card inside. We hadn't yet had any spot checks from soldiers checking our ID cards on the farm, and while Father's story of the La Panca roundups in town had frightened me a little, I didn't yet appreciate how close the danger was. Monday to Saturday, I toiled with Mama on the land, sometimes working in the fields from before the sun rose until after it had set again. I'd take the animals to graze before the sun rose, let the chickens out to roam the house yard, and then I'd join my parents in the fields. Almost everything that needed to be done had to be done by hand, an endlessly laborious cycle of plowing and planting and weeding and harvesting, then plowing again. Mama, Father, and my two strapping brothers had struggled to keep up, even with my half-hearted help. But now the twins were gone, and with Father's rheumatism worsening whenever the cold came in, Mama and I had to struggle to maintain the usual workload, effectively on our own. The blisters on my hands grew until they joined and then popped, and the raw skin gradually morphed into a thick, dirt-stained callus that covered each palm. I spent so much of the daytime bending over in the fields that by nighttime, I'd have to lie in a fetal position because my back would spasm if I tried to lie straight. I fretted for my brothers and for Tomas, but during the daytime, the mere act of surviving took so much energy that thoughts of those missing were just background noise beneath the constant terror. We had to make the land work harder because our very survival depended on it. I had no capacity during the long days to think about anything other than work and the dread that would leave me frozen every time we saw a Nazi vehicle anywhere near our gate. It was only when the frantic activity stopped at bedtime that I'd let myself focus on Felipe, Stanislav, and Tomas. I'd pray for my brothers with whatever energy I had left, and then I'd open my drawer, fumble for Mama's ring, and fix my mind for one pure moment on Tomas. Sometimes I relived a memory. Sometimes I imagined a reunion. Often I thought about our wedding day, planning that victorious moment in irrational detail, right down to the number of ruby-red poppies I'd carry in my bouquet. I could still see him so clearly in my mind. The laughing green eyes, the lopsided smile, the way his hair flopped forward onto his forehead, and he'd push it back out of habit, only for it to fall forward again immediately. The problem was that once thoughts of Tomas filled my mind, desperate longing was never far behind. In the quiet seconds before sleep overtook me, I was sometimes overcome with despair at my helplessness, and I'd wake with gritty eyes from having sobbed myself to sleep. I had no power to change my lot. All I had was the breath in my lungs, and a tiny fragment of hope that if I kept moving forward, I could survive until someone else changed my world. The quotas for our produce increased and increased. Eventually, Father had to load the cart with all of our produce, and he'd take it all into town to hand over to the soldiers. In return, They would give him our allotment of ration stamps. The first time he returned with food, I thought I'd somehow misunderstood the arrangement. You have to go collect the food every day?
No, Alina, Father said impatiently. This must last us the week.
The rations were not simply scant. They were untenable. Father had returned with a bag of flour, small blocks of butter and cheese, a half dozen eggs, and some tinned meat.
How will we live off this? I asked my parents. We have so much work to do. How can we run the farm with just the three of us when they are only feeding us scraps?
There are plenty who have it worse than us, Mama said.
Worse?
It seemed unfathomable. Mama's gaze grew impatient, but this time it was Father who spoke.
This is nearly 700 calories per day for each of us. The Jews are only allotted 200 calories each per day. And, child, you think our farm work is hard? Come into the town with me next time and see the way the Jewish work crews are being treated.
I want to go into the town, I said, lifting my chin. You won't let me.
It's not safe for you there, Alina. Do you know what kinds of things those monsters have done to some of the girls in the township? Do you know what might...
We will get by,
Mama interrupted him suddenly, and we all fell quiet. It seemed to me that we had a choice. Break the rules and survive, or follow the rules and starve. And I was terrified my parents were going to choose the second option. I cleared my throat, and I suggested,
We could just keep some of our food, just a little. We can just take a few eggs or some of the vegetables.
The invaders say that our farms belong to the Reich now,
Father said.
Withholding our produce would see us imprisoned, or worse. Do not suggest such a thing again, Alina.
But...
Leave it, Alina,
Mama said flatly. I looked at her in frustration, but then I noticed her determined stance. Her body language told me what her words did not. Mama had a plan, but she had no intention of sharing it with me.
Just do your jobs and stop asking so many questions. When you need to worry... Father and I will tell you to worry.
I am not a baby, Mama, I cried in frustration. You treat me like a child.
You are a child, Father said.
His voice shook with passion and frustration. We stared at each other, and I saw the shine of tears in my father's eyes. I was so shocked by this that I didn't quite know what to do. The urge to push and argue with them drained in an instant. Father blinked rapidly, then he drew in a deep breath, and he said unevenly,
You are our child, and you are the only thing we have left to fight for. We will do what we must to protect you, Alina, and you should think twice before you question us.
His nostrils flared suddenly, and he pointed to the door as the tears in his eyes began to swell.
Go and do your damn jobs!
I wanted to push, and I would have except for those shocking tears in Father's eyes. After that day, I put my head down and I continued in the rhythm where work consumed my life. On an unseasonably warm day in late fall, I was working the berry patch, which was just beside the house at the place where the slope first steepened. An early wind had settled and the sun was now out in full force, so I was tanning myself. At lunchtime, I changed into my favorite dress, a lightweight floral sundress I'd inherited from Truda. It certainly wasn't an immodest outfit. I didn't own any immodest outfits. But I had chosen that dress because the cut of the neckline meant I could enjoy the warmth of the sun on my arms and upper chest. I was crouched on the ground, harvesting ripe berries and rusting them in a wicker basket, periodically plucking weeds as I found them, and throwing them into a pile beside the patch. Father was having an unusually bad day. He was in such pain from his hips that Mama had opted to stay inside with him to care for him. I heard the truck approach, then slow. I held my breath as I always did when I heard vehicles rumbling past our house, but then released it in a rush when I saw the truck pull into our drive. Just as the roar of the truck engine stopped, there came the sound of the front door opening. That's when I remembered my ID card. I'd remembered to put it in the pocket of the heavier skirt I'd been wearing that morning, and when I'd changed at lunchtime, I'd left that skirt on my bed, and my papers were still inside. I prayed that they'd leave without approaching me, but I stood even as I did so, because I had little expectation that my prayer would be answered, and I didn't want to be crouching in the dirt alone when they came. There were only two of them this time. One was middle-aged, balding, and so fat that it made me angry to think about how much food he must eat to maintain his build. His companion was startlingly young, probably the same age as my brother's. I wondered about that young soldier, whether he was scared to be away from his family, as my brothers surely were. For a moment, I felt a pang of empathy, but it disappeared almost immediately when I saw the look on the boy's face. Like his older companion, his expression was set in a scornful mask as he surveyed our small home, even given the slight distance between us. There was no mistaking the disdainful curl of his lip and the flare in his nostrils. With the locked set of his shoulders and the way his hand hovered over the leather holster at his hip housing his gun, it was clear that this boy was simply looking for an excuse to release his aggression. And I was standing in a field in a sundress without my ID card, a red flag waving in the wind before an angry bull. The older man approached the house, but that young man just stood and stared all around. His gaze traced the tree line at the woods on the hill above and behind me, then shifted ever closer to the place where I stood. I wished and wished and wished that I had some way to make myself invisible as the young man shifted back to face Mama and Father, his gaze skimming past me. I thought for a second he hadn't noticed me or didn't care to pay me even a hint of attention, but just as the relief started to rise and I exhaled the breath I was holding, the young soldier frowned and then tilted his head almost curiously. It was as if he'd missed me at first and had only belatedly registered that I was there. He once again raised his eyes, only this time his gaze locked onto mine. There was palpable disgust in his eyes, but it was mixed with an intense, unsettling greed. My stomach lurched, and I looked away from him as fast as I could. But I still felt his eyes on me, searing me somehow, until I fought to suppress an overwhelming urge to cross my arms over my body. I knew I couldn't stand there, frozen. To do so would draw more attention to myself, and that would only increase the chance of them approaching me, and if they did, I was done for. I knew they wouldn't let me go into the house to get my papers. That would be an act of kindness. And kindness was not something the Nazis felt the Poles deserved. They considered us to be Untermensch, or subhuman, only slightly above the Jews on their perverted racial scale of worth. I had to act busy. I had to be busy. Wasn't that how we were to save ourselves? Be productive, keep the farm working, produce at any cost. This had been our mantra since the invasion. I tried to convince myself that strategy would save me now, too, even in the face of such direct intensity from this soldier. The trickle of adrenaline in my system turned to a flood, and I felt sweat running down my spine right along with it. I started to move, but my movements were jerky and my palms were so damp, and when I bent to pick up my wicker basket, it slipped straight back into the dirt. The hundreds of berries I'd picked all tumbled out, and I looked back up in a panic to see the soldier laughing scornfully, mocking me without a single word. I dropped to my knees and began to scoop the berries up. My hands were shaking so hard that I couldn't coordinate the movements, and each time I lifted a handful of berries toward the basket, I'd drop as many as I rescued. I didn't need to look up to know his eyes were still on me. I could feel the intensity of his attention, as if he could somehow stare all the way through my clothes. If I ran, they would shoot me, and I was too terrified to think clearly enough to find some work I could legitimately do that might take me away from his view. I was stuck naked under his stare, exposed to his gaze in the light summer dress I had chosen with such innocent optimism and the hopes of a pleasant afternoon in the sun. At the house, I could hear the older soldier and father attempting a conversation in German, but it was stilted and awkward because father knew only a little more German than I did. There was a quiet discussion. Then father said something about Osvienchim, a town not far from ours. And all the while the young soldier stared at me. The older soldier barked at father, and then spun on his heel in the dust and turned back toward his car. That's when the younger soldier spoke for the first time. He turned lazily toward father, cast a disdainful look toward my parents, and then looked right at me again as he spoke, just loud enough for me to hear a rapid-fire sentence that I couldn't translate. The older soldier called to him, and the two piled into the car, and then they left. I collapsed into the dirt, confused by how tense that moment had been, and confused as to why even now that they were gone, my stomach was still rolling violently. I pressed my hands to my belly, so focused on the discomfort within my body that I barely noticed Mama approaching.
"You are okay," she said abruptly. "We are okay."
"I didn't have my papers on me," I choked.
Mama groaned impatiently.
"Alina, if they had checked."
"I know," I said, my voice breaking. "I know, Mama, I keep forgetting, but I'll try to be more careful next time."
"No," Mama snapped, shaking her head. "You forget all the damn time, Alina. We won't risk it again. I'll hold your papers for you, and we'll make sure if you're outside in the field, I am close beside you."
The cage around me was shrinking, but after the 5 minutes that had just passed, I didn't mind that one bit.
"What did they want?" I asked Mama.
"They were lost. They needed directions to the barracks. Father thinks they were looking for Osvienchim," she said.
Then she looked toward the hill, her gaze distant for a moment. When she looked at me again, her eyebrows knit.
You must wear a scarf in the fields, or one of father's hats. You should... always now. You must hide your hair. And you must..."
She looked down at my body, and she ran her hand through her own hair.
"Perhaps you must wear your brother's clothes."
She trailed off again, then gave me a searching, somewhat helpless look.
"Do you understand what I am telling you, Alina?"
"Did I do something wrong, Mama? What did that soldier say to me?"
"He was speaking to father,"
Mama said. Then she sighed.
"He told father that he has a pretty daughter."
She met my gaze and she raised her eyebrows.
"We must do everything we can to ensure that the next passing soldier does not see a pretty daughter. We cannot hide you away altogether, so you must try to hide yourself in other ways. Yes?"
I never, ever wanted to feel so exposed ever again. I wanted to burn that summer dress and wear a coat everywhere I went for the rest of my life. I'd never really thought about my appearance too much before, but that day, I hated the way I looked. I hated my thick chestnut hair and my wide blue eyes, and I loathed the curve of my breasts and hips. If there had been a way to make myself invisible, I'd happily have taken it. I was tempted to rush inside and change into my brother's large, boring clothes right that second. Mama dropped to her knees beside me and helped me collect the last of the berries I'd dropped.
"If they ever approach you," she said suddenly, "do not struggle. Do you understand me, Alina? You let them do what they..."
It was so rare for her to search for words. I squeezed my eyes shut, and she reached across and gripped my forearm until I opened them again.
"There is no need for them to kill you, if they can get what they want from you. Just remember that."
I shook my head, and Mama's grip on my arm became painfully tight.
"Reap is a weapon, Alina," she said. "Just as killing our leaders was a weapon, and taking our boys was a weapon, and starving us half to death is a weapon. They see you are strong in the face of all their other tactics, so they will try to control you in other ways. They will try to take your strength from the inside. If they come for you, be smart and brave enough to overcome the instinct to try to flee or resist. Then, even if they hurt your body, you will survive.
I sobbed once, but she held my gaze until I nodded through my tears. Only then did her gaze soften.
Alina, she sighed. Now do you understand why we do not want you to go into the town? We are all vulnerable. We are all powerless. But you, my daughter, you are naive, and you are beautiful. That leaves you at risk in ways you are only beginning to understand.
Yes, Mama, I choked. Frankly, I never wanted to leave the house again, let alone the farm. Any thought of visiting the town was forgotten for a long while after that day. It wasn't the only time the soldiers came to our gate. Spot checks for our papers and random visits to unnerve us soon became a way of life. Those moments were always terrifying, but never again did I feel so exposed, because that was the last time a soldier came to our gate and found me working alone in a field. Mama was always near me after that day, with our identity papers nestled safely in the pockets of her undergarments. That day was also the very last time a soldier visited to find me wearing my own clothes, and the last time anyone ever came to our gate and found me with my long hair down around my shoulders. That fall day, a young Nazi soldier had taken my innocence without ever coming within 100 feet of me. On Sunday, Truda and Mateusz would walk Emilia up the hill on the town side and then down the hill to our house to join us for lunch. We'd see them coming down from the hill. Emilia was inevitably hand in hand with my sister, a scrap of paper or a little bunch of wildflowers held tightly in her other hand. Mateusz always walked close behind them, and I understood that this was a protective gesture, but I also knew it was ultimately a pointless one. If a soldier wished to do any of us harm, there was nothing to be done about it, not even for my tall, strong brother-in-law. Emilia had adjusted quickly to life with her new family, and Truda and Mateusz clearly adored Emilia in return. That little girl loved two things in life most: talking at a million miles an hour, and flowers of every kind. In preparation for that weekly visit, she'd collect a little posy from the park at the end of their street, or she'd draw Mama and I flowers of some sort with some crayons that Truda had procured for her. Most weeks, the flowers were brightly colored, clumsy and cartoonish, and the end result was generally a cheery piece of artwork that warmed my heart to see. Other weeks, she drew with heavy strokes and used only a black crayon. It didn't matter what she drew. I always reacted with surprise and delight to her gift, and in return, I'd be rewarded with her smile. Most Sundays, Amelia's radiant smile was the highlight of my week. Every week she'd hand me her little gift, then ask me breathlessly if I'd heard news about Tomas. Every week I'd pretend I was still sure he was fine, and it was only a matter of time before he came home.
Of course he is. He's alive and he's well and he's doing everything he can to get back to us. How can you be so sure? He promised me, silly, and Tomas would never lie to me. Thank you, big sister.
She'd sigh and she'd hug me tightly. Life on the farm was hard, but for the most part in the first few years it was quiet. Mama's theory seemed correct. We kept our heads down and we worked hard. And other than those sporadic spot checks, the occupation raged on around us. We were starved of food and missing our boys, but life was almost tolerable. On Sunday, I was always reminded that life in the town was not nearly so simple. At those Sunday lunches, Truda and Mateusz were stoic, but Emilia was still far too young to hide her trauma. It would spill out of her without prelude or warning, randomly disturbing sentences that none of us really knew how to react to.
And then the Jews were fixing the building, but
but the soldier said, "Filthy Jew," and he hit the old man in the face with the shovel and...
Enough of that talk at lunch, Emilia.
Truda always spoke to her with the perfect blend of firm and soft. Emilia would glance around the table, clear her throat, and then go back to eating her food in silence. Another week, we were having a quiet conversation about the chickens when Emilia looked at me and said without preamble,
"The woman was dead in the pond at the park, Alina. She was floating with her face in the water, and her skin was all puffy and the water turned pink."
"Emilia," Truda winced, but she was flustered. I told you not to look at that. I told you.
Emilia looked between us all, her brow creasing.
"Have some more lunch, child,"
Mama said hastily, and she scooped Emilia's plate up to slide an extra potato pancake onto it.
"Don't think about such things."
After lunch, the adults would sip at watered-down coffee, and I'd often take Emilia to sit on the steps beside the barn so that she could talk freely for a few minutes. I hated that this sweet, innocent child was surrounded by death and ugliness, but I could also see that she needed to talk about those things, even if the rest of our family couldn't bear to hear it.
"I like Truda and Mateusz, but I miss Tomas and my father,"
she told me one Sunday.
"I miss them too."
"I don't like the mean soldiers in our town, and I don't like dead people everywhere, and I don't like it when the guns shoot in the night, and I don't know if the bullet is coming for me."
"I know.
Everything scares me too much, and I want it to stop now," she said.
"Me too.
No one ever wants to talk about it. Everyone is so angry with me when I talk about it. Why do they want to pretend it's not happening? Why can't we talk about it?"
"It's just our way, Emilia."
I smiled at her sadly, then pulled her close for a hug. "Sometimes talking about things makes them seem more real. Do you understand that?" Emilia sighed heavily as she nodded.
"I do, but I feel better when I talk about it. I want to understand."
"You can talk to me. I don't understand either, but I'll always listen to you."
"I'm no big sister," she said.
And then at last, her little smile returned. Chapter 9. Alina. We owned an unusually large allotment of chickens for a family in our region, because in the dry years when the crops did not perform well in our poor soil, our family had always survived on a steady diet of eggs. Now those eggs had to be carefully collected and counted, and I didn't dare drop a single one, because the Nazis had set us a quota of exactly 20 eggs per day. Sometimes the chickens laid only 18 or 19 eggs. The first few times we were short, I was in a cold-blooded panic as I searched for the others, and then sick to my stomach when I finally conceded defeat and gave my parents the news. The next day, there was always an extra egg or two, and given Father only took the eggs into town twice a week, it always equalized before the soldiers even knew we were short. We always met the quota. Very occasionally, we produced an egg or two above, but never a single egg less. For a while, I thought Mother Mary was hearing my prayers, and we were being blessed. But over time, I became a little more cynical. Another summer harvest came and went, and I assumed we'd handed over every single morsel of produce as we'd been instructed to. This was usually a busy period for Mama and me, because after the harvest, we would preserve as much as we could to cover the winter months. But now there was no excess to preserve, and our evenings were instead free. It felt strange to me, and I was surprised to find I missed the endless hours of pickling and preserving with Mama that we'd always shared in previous years. But then I woke up late one night and was confused by the heavy sugar scent in the air. I stared up at the ceiling for a long while, wondering if I was imagining things, or perhaps even dreaming. But the smell persisted, and I became increasingly confused. I slipped out of bed to open my door and found Mama standing over the stove. The smell of sugar and strawberries was unmistakably strong in the living area. The oil light was off. The room was illuminated only by the dull flicker of the fire through the grill on the stove. Mama was staring into the pot, her gaze distant and thoughtful.
"What are you doing?"
I asked. She startled out of her daze and looked at me sharply.
"Cleaning the pot," she said abruptly. "Back to bed."
Mama,
I said, my throat suddenly dry. I stared down at the pot over the fire, breathed in the heavy scent again, and forced myself to state the obvious.
"That's jam, Mama. I can see you're making jam."
Mama looked back to the pot for a moment. She stirred some more, and then she turned back to me, a challenge in her gaze.
"Of course it's not jam," she said.
She lifted the spoon so I could see the syrup dripping off it. A drop formed, then fell, and then another. But Mama remained completely silent, even as long moments dragged past us while I watched the spoon and she watched me. My sleepiness cleared, and I swallowed a sudden lump in my throat, then forced my eyes back to Mama. The look in her eyes was so intense that it became very hard to look at her, so I flicked my gaze between Mama and the spoon. In the semi-dark room, the thick red jam looked exactly like blood. It was quite hot in the house because of the fire, but a shiver ran through me from my head to my toes. Mama lowered the spoon back down into the mix and resumed her stirring, and she stared into the pot as she murmured,
"If it was jam, I'd be withholding produce. And if I was caught doing that, I'd be executed. They'd shoot me, or hang me, or beat me to death."
She left another long pause, and for me, that silence was loaded with the sheer terror of the truth of her statement.
"Now, would I ever take such a foolish risk?"
There was an open challenge in her eyes, as if Mama was daring me to say otherwise, and as if me stating the blatantly obvious would be the thing that caused her death. I was shaking now, confronted with the reality of our circumstances in a way that I had easily avoided until that moment. I dropped my chin and shook my head.
"No, Mama, of course you wouldn't,"
I croaked out.
"Good. Go back to bed."
I did. I turned quickly and ran into my room, and even though it was uncomfortably warm, I climbed under my blankets and I pulled them up over my head. Eventually, I fell into a fitful sleep, but when I woke the next morning to watch the sunrise through my window, there was no way I could avoid facing the truth. My mother was hiding food from the Nazis. And now that I knew for sure, I wanted to know exactly how extensive her deceit was. The chickens were hard to count when they were outside during the day, especially because our flock had free rein of the house yard and the large barn during the day. But at night, I would chase them into the barn and lock them away to keep them safe from foxes. The next night, I decided to confirm my suspicions. I locked the chickens in the barn, left them to settle, and then went back to count them once they were still.
"We have 23 chickens plus the roosters," I said to Mama when I went inside.
She looked at me, then frowned.
"No, exactly 20 plus the 3 roosters," she said abruptly.
"Maybe we have some strays then, because I just counted."
"We have exactly 20, Alina,"
Father said flatly. The words bounced around the walls of our small house, and then I knew.
"We have 20 chickens,"
I echoed dully. Jam, eggs, where did it end? I started watching the supplies Father would return with when he went out to get our rations, and I compared it to the food we were eating. We were hardly living a lavish lifestyle, but we all ate eggs most days, despite Father only bringing a half dozen back from the town each week. We'd always had jam with our bread, and I assumed it was left over from the season before the war, but now I looked closely at the jar we were eating from. That very same jar had lasted 4 months. The jam never seemed to go down. I wondered what my diet would look like if it wasn't for the contraband jam and the extra eggs. I wondered what else my parents were doing that they didn't want me to know about. Soon I'd stare at the strawberry jam on my biscuit and feel somehow equally panicked that my mother had risked her life to give it to me and that perhaps it might be the last serving. One morning when Mama and I were collecting the eggs, I waited until she'd rounded the corner of the barn to check the house yard. I ran back inside for the oil lamp, then I forced myself to go down into the dark cavity of the cellar. It had been hard enough to force myself into that space with my whole family around me, even when the threat of bombing was looming. My heart was racing as I climbed inside, but it nearly stopped altogether when I found only a single dusty jar of jam and 2 bolted potatoes. That's when I realized that even worse than the thought of Mama keeping a secret supply of food was the possibility that we'd already exhausted what she had. I clambered out of the cellar and back toward Mama.
Mama, I choked. We have run out of food, haven't we?
No, she said, and she continued her work as if I hadn't spoken. I stared at her in disbelief, then grabbed her upper arm to force her to look at me.
But I went into the cellar.
She silenced me with a single incredulous look, and then she barked a laugh.
Alina, she said, since when do you go into the cellar? I was just so worried.
When you need to be concerned, I will tell you. Until then, work hard. And don't ask so many questions.
But, Mama, I said uneasily, I need to understand.
Sometimes, not understanding something is the wise thing to do.
Mama sighed and she glanced up at me.
We are nothing to the invaders, Alina. We were already poor, so there is not much more for them to take from us. And if they think they are getting all of our produce, they leave us alone, for the most part. But if they suddenly start paying attention, then you and I will discuss this matter. Until that day, you have to trust Father and I to take care of you.
The jam kept coming long after it should have run out, and the potato cakes kept coming on Sundays, and most mornings, Mama would silently serve me a heaping mound of eggs with my ration portion of oatmeal. I saw her slipping potatoes and eggs, and sometimes even a small bag of grain or sugar, into Truda's coat after lunch every Sunday. I saw that all of us looked drawn and too slim, but Emilia somehow kept color in the apples on her cheeks. I saw the large sacks of wheat and sugar my father uncovered in the back of the cart, after a spontaneous trip to the town to visit with Truda. We were surviving only because my parents were covertly skimming from our harvests and making the occasional dip into the black market. It was thriving in those days because every single Polish citizen was in exactly the same position.